The Klal Yisrael asked Hashem for a melech, and Hashem gave Shaul to be the melech of Yisrael. One of the primary functions of the melech was to be the chief executive officer to rid the Jewish nation of the various enemies that we had. We had many enemies, particularly the Pelishtim, were a very, very aggressive and very obnoxious enemy. And one of the main functions of Shaul HaMelech was to wage war against the Pelishtim and to rid them finally from our borders. Various wars were fought, some successfully, some not so successfully. And at a certain point, there was a major challenge that the Pelishtim made to the Klal Yisrael. And Perek Yud Zayin opens up where the Pelishtim armies are gathered on this side of a mountain over here. The Jewish armies are gathered on this side of a mountain over here, and in the center is a very large valley. But this war was a bit different than your standard average battle. This war began by one individual, Goliath, walking out. Now, the pasuk describes this individual. He was humongous. He was huge. He was so tall that it's difficult to believe his height. But it wasn't just that he was tall, he was enormous. He wore the type of armor that's difficult to imagine carrying, and he was literally a gargantuan individual. Each morning he would walk out and he would make the following proclamation: "You are servants of Shaul. Why don't you send out one person to fight me? Instead of all this bloodshed, instead of having two armies clash, send out one individual. If he wins, then we will also be servants to Shaul. And if he loses, then you'll be servants to me." The problem was that no one dared to rise up against this individual. Number one, they knew who he was. He had fought a number of battles against the Klal Yisrael previously. He had killed the two sons of Eli HaKohen. He had taken hold of the Aron. And they knew very well his might, his valor. And everyone was yara, a tremendous, tremendous fear. No one dared take him up on the challenge. Erev Vavokir, each morning and each night, he would walk out and challenge the Jewish nation, and the Jewish nation was filled with fear. No one dared take him up. Finally, recognizing that no one was going to take him up on the challenge, he said, "Okay, fine, just give me a man to fight. Are you a bunch of cowards? Are you losers? Send me out a man. Even if you don't want my challenge, at least send me out someone." For 40 days, morning and night, he would come out in the center of this valley. For 40 days, morning and night, no one dare break ranks from the Klal Yisrael. No one took up his challenge. Interestingly enough, on the 40th day, David comes to the camp. Now, Yishai had a number of sons. Three were active warriors in Shaul's army. Typically, only a certain amount from each family were active within the army. For that reason, David was not active at that time. Shaul knew well who he was, and he was a gibor, but he was not active in the army at the time. He was tending the sheep of his father. His father sent him to find out how his brothers were doing, and David heard the taunts of Goliath, and he felt a tremendous kinah. He felt a tremendous embarrassment for Hashem's honor, and he felt such a busha for the honor of the Shekhinah that he couldn't stand it. He began sending the message to Shaul. He let Shaul know that I will accept the challenge. And Shaul recognized that there was something unique about David's gevura. When David approached Shaul, Shaul tried to dissuade him. He tried to talk him out of it. He said, "You're going to lose. This Goliath is a menura. From the time he's a young lad, all he's known is battle. You can't possibly win this battle. Don't fight him." When Shaul saw that David was not going to relent, finally Shaul said, "Fine, if you're going in the name of Hashem, then let me be a participant with you." And Shaul took his personal armor, his sword, his helmet, and he gave it to David. Now, what was very unusual about that was it wasn't just that it was the armor, the sword, and the helmet of the king. It was that Shaul was heads and shoulders physically taller than the rest of the Klal Yisrael. And David was not. And though that armor should not have fit David, yet miraculously, Rashi explains to us that armor shrunk and fit David to a T. since David was already anointed to be the next king, it was proper, and literally it shrunk on his body, the armor shrunk, and it fit him perfectly. And when he tried it on, there's a very interesting thing that the Pasuk says. Vayachgor David escharbo mi'alamadov. David tied the sword over the armor. Vayol alechet, he attempted to go. Kilonisa. Vayomid David ashol. David at that point said to Shaul, lo uchal leilech, I cannot go be'ila. I cannot go into battle with this armor, with this helmet. I can't do it. Kilonisisi. But the problem is, lonisisi is not clear what it means. And Rashi explains what it means. It's actually the Targum. The Targum says, I cannot go into battle with Goliath wearing this armor. Why? Arid les pohunisa. There is no miracle if I go with this armor. If I walk out in to do battle with Goliath wearing armor, carrying a sword, the miracle will not be clearly recognizable. It isn't a miracle. At which point David took off the armor, put down the sword, and he steps out onto the battlefield holding but his stick and then his shepherd's bag. To Goliath, this was an affront of the highest caliber. This was a rank insult. And Goliath took it as such and said, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And he began being macharef and megadef. He began cursing God. He used his own God's names to curse David. And he went on an entire litany. At which point David, standing in front of the entire Jewish army with the Plishtim on the other side of the mountain, said, you come to me with swords, all types of weapons. I come to you with one thing, the name of God that you've so embarrassed. And I will feed you to the birds in the sky to be their prey. At which point Goliath steps out to meet David. David doesn't step back. He runs out to meet Goliath. He reaches into his pocket, pulls out his slingshot, puts a stone into it, flings it at Goliath, and somehow, miraculously, it enters under the shirion, under the armor, the helmet of Goliath, kills him down dead. And interestingly, instead of falling backwards, he falls face forward. David takes Goliath's sword, cuts off his head, holds it up for all to see that he killed the gibor of the Plishtim. And this is a very, very beautiful story brought to us in Nach, and a very interesting one, and I have two rather simple questions to ask on it. Number one, how in the world did David have that kind of courage, that kind of sheer grit, the moxie, the gvura, to stand up to a physical giant, a man who was at least 10 feet tall, who is so huge that when you hear the description of the weight of the armor, a normal human being could not possibly carry it. He would be crushed under it. And this behemoth is standing out there, who is a warrior from his youth, and David is not a large man, and he doesn't even wear armor. He steps out and says, Laman Hashem, I'm going to slaughter you and feed you to the birds of prey. So the first question is, where did he get the courage from? But the second question, I think, is more important to focus on, and that is, Lechora, it would seem that what David did was wrong. Ein somchen al hanes is a principle that we're very familiar with. You're not allowed to rely on a miracle. You're not allowed to go play in traffic and say, don't worry, God will save me. You're not going to go to a high building and practice bungee cord jumping because you want to practice to see the elasticity of a cord. That's forbidden. Ein somchen al hanes is a principle that operates in kol ha'Torah kula. And not only did David rely on the miracle, the very armor, the very sword that would have given him a chance in battle, the very normalcy of the situation, which would have been to go out there and fight with armor, he says, I can't fight with these because it won't be a miracle. It won't be quite recognizable enough. He takes off the armor, takes off the helmet, puts down the sword, and goes out with a stick and a shepherd bag. That is the ultimate example of relying on a miracle. Question one is, where did he get the courage? Question two is, lechora, it seems that he's wrong. He should not have done that. And I'd like to see if we can answer these questions this evening. And to do that, I'd like to borrow on something that we began touching on last week. And that is that even though our religion is primarily an issue of practice, of mitzvahs, of learning, every once in a while we sometimes delve into theology. And the reason we should do it is because, again, as much as we can, our job is to understand our Creator. And as much as we can, our job is to develop a relationship with Hashem. However, as I mentioned last week, that is a very difficult job for us mortal human beings to do, because relating to Hashem means relating to something, someone so beyond our normal understanding that it's completely out of our frame of reference. But with that as a caveat, let's begin. There is something I mentioned previously, which once upon a time was considered a major philosophical question. Now, I doubt any of you have been troubled by this question. I doubt you know anyone who's given up their religion because of it. But believe it or not, once upon a time, the following question was considered so profound that many people could not accept Hashem because of it. And here's the question. Please don't laugh. It's meant seriously. The question is, can Hashem create a rock that Hashem can't pick up? Right? Listen, Hashem is Kol Yachol. Hashem is all-powerful. Now watch this. If Hashem is all-powerful, He can do anything. Anything means anything. Anything means that He can create a rock that's so heavy, so stupendously heavy, that Hashem can't pick it up. Oh, wait a minute. Hashem can't pick it up. Oh, that means He can't do something. Oh, no. Hashem can't create such a rock. Oh, so He can't create such a rock. So He's not Kol Yachol. He's not all stupendous. No, He can. Believe it or not, people have apparently bought into that as such a serious philosophical issue that because of it they could not accept God and they became apikorsim, etc., etc. And even though, again, I don't think we really have been troubled by that question, and I doubt any of us are really in the realm of like, oh my goodness, that's a problematic area for me, I'd like to deal with it because I think understanding the answer to it, I think, will help us a little bit understand a little bit better our relationship with our Creator. And that is really something that I've mentioned in a previous shmooze but begs to be repeated. How do we relate to our Creator? Columbus discovered America. What that means is there was a continent, there was a land, there were trees, rocks, rivers, there were even indigenous people living there. Columbus discovered that land. Columbus did not invent America. He discovered it. And let me explain to you why that's a very important principle. Any creative act that a human being ever does is not creative. It's not inventing, it's discovering, taking two objects that were there already, putting them together in a different format, in a different order, but he has really, in any real sense, created nothing. If I take two pieces of wood, I take some nails, and I bang them together, what I've taken is entities that have been in existence prior, put them together in a different form, in a different fashion, and I've made something new. But again, in reality, I haven't created anything. When Hashem created this world, that's a yesh me'ayin creation. Yesh me'ayin means there was nothing. Nothing means there was no wood, there were no atoms, there were no quarks, there was no physicality. When Hashem created everything that we now experience, Hashem brought forth from nothing absolutely everything. The very bedrock, physicality, the quarks, the atoms, the sand of the bricks, the building, everything. The difference between a yesh miyesh creation is a yesh miyesh. If something's there and you put it together in different form, you really haven't created anything. Yesh mi'ayin, if there's nothing there and you brought it forth, is creative. And you know what the key difference is? The Nefesh HaChaim explains to us that the key difference is that if I put two pieces of wood together, nail them and make a house out of them, and leave that house for 20 years, if I come back 20 years later, I expect that house to remain standing, albeit a bit weathered, maybe not quite as pristine, but the house is still there. However, when Hashem created this world, there was nothing, and Hashem brought it forth. And when Hashem brought it forth, it's not just that Hashem brought it forth. Every particle of physicality requires Hashem's constantly infusing energy to keep it into existence. Because if for a split second Hashem would cease to infuse energy, matter itself would cease to exist. You see, Hashem is the creator, the one who brought from nothing something. And when you create from nothing that piece of wood, it requires something to keep it in existence. Without Hashem constantly keeping that, physicality would cease to exist. And when we say Hashem is the creator, it doesn't just mean that Hashem made a new Bria. It means that Hashem made the existence itself, and Hashem keeps it in existence. And a mushal that I've given in the past, but again begs repeating, is as follows. If you'd like to understand Hashem's relationship to this world, imagine the following. Imagine it's a cold February day, and you and I are standing at the bus stop, and I start shivering. I'm shivering, nothing keeps me warm. I close my eyes and I imagine a beautiful scene. White sand, cloudless sky, 85 degree beach weather, beautiful. I'm sitting there, I watch one lone seagull gently flap its wings across the sky, and at that moment the bus comes, splash! I open my eyes, gone is the white sand, gone is the seagull, gone is the 85 degrees. I am the keeper of the dream. I created the sand, I made the seagull, and I made the temperature. I, as the creator of the dream, am the one who keep it in existence. If you'd like to understand Hashem's relationship to physicality, Hashem is the Mahava. Mahava of the Bria means the one who created and keeps it, maintains every particle of physicality exactly where it is. And if for a split second Hashem would cease infusing energy, it would be like I to the seagull. The seagull would cease to exist the minute I stopped thinking about it. So too the world itself would cease existing if Hashem would stop constantly keeping it exactly where it is. Now, that may seem very lofty and very difficult to get your hands on, but that is the ultimate level of Yiras HaRomamus. Yiras HaRomamus means the ultimate awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The ultimate awe of Hashem is when you look at a rock and you say, Hashem is right here. Hashem is present right at this point. And how do I know that? Because this very rock, this domain, would cease to exist if Hashem was not constantly keeping it here. And the mountains and the birds and the ocean sings out that Hashem created it, but not just created it once upon a time, is the creator, because it requires Hashem's constant infusion of energy to keep it in existence. Now, you have two choices. You could either accept that, because the Nefesh HaChayim tells us that is Hashem's relationship to the world, or if you'd like a real challenge, think about it for a long time. If you go for a long walk in the woods and you think about completely ayin, nothing, no physicality, I believe it is well within our capacity to understand that when Hashem created it, it needs Hashem's constant infusion of energy, and therefore every part of the world screams out, Hashem is here, Hashem is keeping it, and that is a very high level of yira. To walk every step of your life, to experience Hashem constantly right there with you, totally involved in the world because you understand it has to be there, is a very great level and a very high level. The reality is that it is rare that we'll actually attain that level. Halavai, we theoretically understand it. Halavai, at certain points we get it, maybe during davening. And the Silas Sharm describes Tefillah. Tefillah, he says, is I'm having a conversation with my Creator, literally like I'm speaking to my friend right here. Hashem is present. So sometimes we'll feel it. However, Rabbeinu Avram ben Rambam wrote a sefer. The Rambam's son wrote a sefer. It's called the Maspik L'Ovdei Hashem. And he describes that once upon a time, there were different types of Jews. He says there was a certain group of Jews, amongst them Nevi'im, some of them Nevi'im, who reached such a high level of understanding that they literally saw this, felt this on a constant, regular basis. He says even they had their ups and downs, even the greatest of them can never maintain this all the time, but they reached such heights of understanding that reality to them was starkly different than it is to us. You see, when we walk the street, we're alone. I'm in big trouble. One little hiccup in the marketplace and I'm really starting to tremble. Lehman Brothers went down. Do you know what that means to me? Do you know what that means? I'm in big trouble. And I'm in big trouble because I'm alone in this world. And that is something that we who don't understand reality fall for, but that's not the real world. The real world, every once in a while we get a glimpse of, is that Hashem is completely, utterly, totally involved in every facet of creation. That means Hashem is present. Hashem is not just involved in the big picture issues, not only involved in the intricacies of all the details. Hashem is present in every particle of physicality. You can't walk a single step in this world without seeing Hashem. We, unfortunately, don't see that. But once upon a time, there were people, and the people who felt that, saw that in a very real way. Says Ben Rambam, that was Dovid HaMelech. You see, Dovid HaMelech experienced Hashem right there, palpably, physically, every rock, every stream, every bird that sang in the forest was Hashem's presence, Hashem keeping it there. And when Dovid HaMelech walked, he walked with Hashem. And the Rambam, son of the Rambam, explains that is exactly what happened when Dovid HaMelech saw Goliath. You know what he saw? He saw an illusion. He saw a mirage. Ooh, big scary. Ooh, big man. You're kept in existence. Your musculature, your bones, your armor is kept in existence because Hashem is keeping it there. And if for a moment Hashem would say, poof, you'd be gone. You're an illusion. You're a mirage. You're a fake. You and I don't see it that way. And because you and I don't see it that way, we're not allowed to do what Dovid HaMelech did. What Dovid HaMelech did was not Somech al Hanes. Dovid saw reality for what it was. And what it was is that Hashem is keeping every particle of physicality in existence. Hence, it wasn't a miracle. Hashem could say Goliath should stand on his head. Hashem could put his arms backwards. Hashem could make Goliath inside out, backwards, forwards. It doesn't matter to Hashem. And because he had that clarity of understanding, it wasn't a Nes. And he walked out there and said, however Hashem saved me before, Hashem will save me again. However, that doesn't apply to us. Because he says, this concept only applies to very, very select individuals when they have Ruach HaKodesh. When they have either a very direct sign from Hashem, or they have a Nevuah to that extent. What was David's sign? David said to Shaul before he went out, Hashem who saved me from the lion and the bear, that was a remez to an event that happened to David prior to this. Dovid HaMelech was watching his father's sheep, and a lion came and grabbed one of the sheep. Dovid HaMelech ran after that lion, and apparently the lion at some point wouldn't give up the sheep. Dovid grabbed it. Another lion attacked Dovid. He was unarmed. He grabbed that lion by the beard and broke his neck. He killed the first lion, killed the second lion with his bare hands. Apparently he was also attacked by a dove, by a bear, and he took that as a sign. Hashem who saved me from those will save me from Goliath. He had a sign in Shemayim, and he walked with that understanding, with that clarity. And that is a real Eved Hashem who sees with absolute clarity of thought who is the Creator and how involved Hashem is. And I believe that is a huge concept and a huge chiddush. You see, Dovid HaMelech didn't need to take a leap of faith. Every time we have a challenge, it's a leap of faith because we don't see Hashem right there. Dovid HaMelech saw it right there all the time. Okay, now, I'd like to share with you something that I consider very interesting and very eye-opening. In 1889, Charles Moret, who was a magician, came up with a stunt that was unmatched and unparalleled. Now, for centuries, magicians had been doing magic. Now, everyone knew what magic was and what magic is. It's sleight of hand. It's an illusion. Meaning, when the magician pulls the rabbit out of the hat, everyone knows he really didn't just make it happen. He didn't really just, there was no rabbit. He made the rabbit exist. The rabbit was hiding somewhere in there. Either it's mirrors, smoke. There's some way that it was hiding. And through sleight of hand, through illusion, he made you think that he created it. But everyone in the audience, as well as he himself, knows fully well, he didn't make the rabbit. He didn't create the rabbit. But here was a problem. And Charles Moret took the stage. It looked way too real. You see, his sister sat on stage, and she was blindfolded. And Charles Moret would go from person to person and ask them to give an object. Whatever the object was. Anyone in the audience, please give me an object. And he would then say the words, yes, thank you. And from the stage, she would say, you're holding a gold watch with Roman numerals made in England. You go over to another person in the audience, ask him for something. And his sister on the stage, blindfolded, impossible for her to see, would say, you're holding a cigarette case made of gold and enamel. Then a few moments later, he'd ask for another object. You're holding a purse, a small purse made of silk, object after object. And the problem was that it looked too real. You see, up until that point, everyone had been faking by using code words. The trick had been the magician would go and he'd use various code words that the person on the stage would know how to read. The person would say, oh, thank you very much, what do we have here, what is this object? And those were code words that told the supposed mind reader on stage what it referred to. But the problem was here that Charles Moret only used the words yes, thank you, then he'd shuffle on. And somehow, every time, he'd pick up an object and she'd get it right on time, and it looked way too real. Now, would you like to know the trick? Here's the trick. Very careful timing. They both memorized a list of 40 items. The first items were objects, 40 types of objects that they'd race through in their mind, one after another. A cigarette case, dagger, whatever the various objects were. The next list were materials, the type of materials made from. They'd race through in their mind very quickly, the material. The next list were characteristics. He would pick up the object in his mind, he'd be racing through the list. When it got to the right thing, he'd say, thank you. That was a signal that it was a cigarette case. When he'd pick it up and he'd say, yes, actually that was a signal of the object. Then when he said, thank you, 1.3 seconds later, she and he both were racing through their mind through the various characteristics. And the simple words, yes, thank you, and then shuffling off with the exact timing to tell her what the object, the material, and the characteristics were. A great trick, fooled the audience, but that's all it was. An illusion, a sleight of hand. The reason why I share that with you is because when scientists look at nature, what they try to do is find the sleight of hand. They debunk it. You see, in the medieval times, people would look at a seed grow into a tree, and they would say, that's God. They would see a cow give birth to a calf, an exact replica of it, but smaller, with all of the details, with the hoofs and the eyes, and they'd say, that's God. Man saw Hashem clearly. While the scientific revolution brought much understanding to mankind, there was a tremendous travesty that they also brought. What they tried to bring was debunking God. You see, we found the trick. We found the mechanism. We found the system. It's not God. It's a division of cells. It's not God. It's photosynthesis. It's not God. It's just sleight of hand. It's just an illusion. And the reason why I think that understanding is key for us is because when you understand what that means, you understand that that doesn't devalue the miracle, it improves our understanding of the miracle. You see, if I recognize the system that Hashem used to create something, it doesn't make it that the creation isn't great. It doesn't make it that, oh, no big deal, it's just an illusion. See, when I see the smoke in the mirrors, and when I see that there's a false bottom to the box, I recognize that he's just a bluff, he's a fake, he's a showman. He's not a real magician who has powers, he's just a showman. But when I discover the system via which Hashem runs the world, I discover the intricacies of Hashem's world, and I discover the wisdom, and I have a greater awe and understanding and appreciation of what Hashem has brought forth. Not a lessening of the awe, but quite the opposite, a tremendous intensification of it. And I'd like to repeat something that I said in an old shmooze just to illustrate this point very, very well. I have three questions that I believe can take a person from absolute atheism and bring him to emunah. And those three questions I think should be rather obvious. Let me share with you what they are. If you take a little seed, a tiny little seed, and you plant it in the ground and wait a good little while, a little bit of water, a little bit of sunshine, what comes out after a while is a very large, robust orange tree. Now, here are the three questions. Question number one is as follows. It starts with a very small seed. And then, a little while later, we get this very massive tree weighing thousands of pounds. Where did all the stuff come from? You know, all the cellulose, the wood, you know, all that, the branches, the wood. Where did all that stuff come from? So, naturally, what you're going to say is, oh, it's obvious, it came from the ground, right? Well, here's the problem. If you take 500 pounds and put it in a metal canister, 500 pounds of dirt, put it in a metal canister, put the seed in that 500 pounds of dirt, and watch that seed grow year after year, thousands of pounds of tree will grow, yet the same 500 pounds of dirt will be in that same metal container. So would you like to know where the stuff of the tree came from? The answer is basic scientific concept called photosynthesis. Photosynthesis means that, I don't know exactly how, but the chlorophyll in the leaves somehow take the sun, they take the carbon dioxide in the air, take the water, and they manufacture glucose. They make the sugar. The thousands of pounds of the tree came from the air. Photosynthesis, just from nowhere, a little bit of carbon dioxide, a little bit of water, and poof, you have thousands of pounds of trees with branches with bark with oranges growing on it. That's a pretty impressive little sleight of hand. Here's the next question. I got where the thousands of pounds of tree came from, but if you bite into an orange, you ever notice there's a very specific and unique flavor to the orange? It's very sweet, sort of tangy but sweet. Here's the question. Where did the sweetness come from? Now, folks, I don't know if you ever hear the expression, but I'll make you eat dirt. I don't know if you've ever tasted dirt, but it does not taste very, very sweet. There's no an orange tangy taste to the dirt. In fact, dirt is just, ugh, I don't know, it's ugh. It doesn't taste sweet at all. So where does that wonderful sweet flavor come from? The answer should be obvious by now. It's called photosynthesis. You see, you got the water, you got the carbon dioxide, chlorophyll in the leaves, just photosynthesis. Photosynthesis means, by the way, photo, light, synthesis. It just makes it from nowhere, from the air, from the light, just poof, makes it. Don't get bent out of shape. It's an illusion. It's a trick. It's sleight of hand. Don't get all nervous and get religious on me over here. It's just something that happens, okay? Whatever. But here's the question. To me, this is the killer question. Okay. An orange is what color? Right. Okay. Now, here's the question. The seed is white. And by the way, even if you cut open the seed, you'll see a lot of white. The dirt is brown. The water is clear. Where did the orange color come from? If you dig down to China, you will not find a depository of red dye number 40 mixed with a little bit of yellow. We get the orange. There's no orange in the dirt. There's no orange in the water. There's no orange in the seed. Where in the world did the orange color come from? Don't panic. Don't get bent out of shape. Photosynthesis. It's the lelves. You know, they take the carbon dioxide, take the water, they synthesize it. We got orange. Do not get religious on me. Don't start saying, wow, that's miraculous. It happens, it occurs. It's just one of those things you just got to get used to. But you see, once you understand the mechanism, then you realize it's not God and it's not wonderful. And what's even better is when you study the mechanism even more up close and you see the details of it and you wonder how the water knows to go up and the root system knows to go as wide as a tree and you start studying how the cellular walls know to form this orange sac and you start studying why the sweetness of the orange is only on the inside but the peel has got the smell of the orange but not the sweetness of the orange and all those little things are brought about by the elf called photosynthesis. Yeah, right. It almost makes you wonder, and it almost makes you look at a science textbook and say, do you believe that nonsense? Do you actually believe that happens? You have either two choices. Either say this whole thing is a farce, or admit to the fact something astounding is going on here. And don't tell me that you found the method, and therefore you've debunked God. When you find the mechanism, when you find the system, you found the beauty of Hashem's world. You found the majesty of Hashem's creation. You now should feel a tremendous sense of awe of Yira. However, my friends, that's really just the beginning. If you'd like to come to a real sense of Yira Shamayim, I'll share with you one very, very significant concept that the Ramban tells us. The Ramban tells us that Teva is a lie. What we accept as nature, the laws of nature, gases tend to expand, heat tends to rise. Says the Ramban, that's an illusion, it's a bluff, it's not reality. When you see those properties, it means that is the way that Hashem is Noheg, runs the world. That's the way that Hashem acts in the world and allows the world to continue. And let me share with you what should be a very important philosophical question that is applicable to your life. Do you ever wonder the following? Maybe, just maybe, Hashem created the world, the heavens and the earth, and left. Why not? Maybe Hashem, being very magnanimous, very generous, decided, let me give to man, so I'll make a beautiful world, I'll make trees, rivers, oceans, I'll create it, and then Hashem left. How do you know not? Maybe. Now I want to share with you the answer to that question, and I don't care which answer you hear. Either one is fully acceptable. One choice to accept is because that's what Chazal tell me. That's the Masorah that I have, that Hashem created the world and runs the world. That's fully acceptable, by the way. However, if you really want to know the correct answer to the question, the world itself, its physical existence, its systems, screams out to the fact that Hashem is present here. If you really understand the Nefesh HaChaim, you understand a domain, a rock, cannot exist without Hashem keeping it in complete, total, utter existence. And that means, domain means inanimate objects. But once you begin studying the systems, the mechanisms of the world, if you really understand it, what it means is that Hashem is right there telling which cell to divide, at which point, at which moment, all of the mechanisms, all of the synthesis, all of the creations that are going on a daily basis in this world, is Hashem right there allowing it to happen in the exact format that Hashem wrote. But the point is, when you watch that little seed become a powerful orange tree, you're watching Hashem telling each cell to divide, telling each part to go to which part to go where. You're watching Hashem's involvement in the world. And while you and I may be able to hear that in theory, and it may be an important answer for our philosophical perspective, David HaMelech lived that. That was his reality, that was his existence, and on a daily basis when he saw a robin hunt the worm, what he understood was there's a chai. A chai has a life force, that life force is kept in existence by Hashem, and is programmed by Hashem, and goes through its motions because Hashem is guiding it, helping it, going through every step of its way. And for David HaMelech, there were no leaps of faith. Everything was Hashem, everything was right there, everything was gully and revealed. Hence when he saw this big, powerful Goliath, he said to Shaul, I cannot wear this armor, and I cannot wear this sword because it'll be an embarrassment to Hashem. I have a simon that Hashem is going to bring a miracle for me. It would be an embarrassment if I debased that miracle by making it look obvious, by making it look pedestrian. Take the armor, take the helmet, keep your sword. I'm going to do battle with Goliath and show the world what Hashem is capable of. Because David HaMelech had such a clarity of vision, because he saw reality for what it was, and that was his level of betachon, his level of emunah on a constant basis. And I think it's something for us to think about, especially in Elul, especially when it's easier to sense Hashem's presence. One of the key growth areas that we need to focus on is on davening and seeing Hashem's presence, feeling Hashem's presence. But how do you feel that? The key to feeling that is understanding that Hashem is involved in every particle of physicality, not just in the economy, not just in the marketplace, not just running the big picture issues, but Hashem is involved in every intricacy of this world, every intricacy of my life, and nothing can exist without Hashem, and certainly nothing can run without Hashem being there. When you understand that, when you understand that all of the systems, all of the mechanisms that science have discovered is great, it's great because it reveals to me the wonder with which Hashem runs the world. It reveals to me the systems that Hashem uses to currently act in the world. It's not a sleight of hand. Unlike the magician, when I've discovered the mirror behind him, when I've discovered that he really doesn't have power, it's quite the opposite. Here I see this galus hashchina. I see Hashem much more clearly. And that's something that David HaMelech lived with. And that's something that requires a lot of thinking about and a lot of working on. Let me close with one last interesting thought. In 1918, Harry Houdini took the stage. It was the Hippodrome, which then was the largest, one of the largest theaters in the world. 3,000 people were in attendance, and he bragged about the fact that he was going to make an elephant disappear. Now, Harry Houdini had been famous already for doing pretty nifty tricks, but he was an escape artist. Most of what he did was getting out of shackles, and this was rather unique because he marched out onto the stage a fully grown elephant in front of Am Va'eda for the thousands of people to see it was real and it was there. And then he brought out a box. He brought out a box and he showed the audience the box, an ordinary box. He then put a ramp by the box. He walked the elephant into the box, closed the door. A moment later, opened the door, and the elephant was gone. Disappeared, not there. But that's not the unusual part of the story. It was the audience reaction. Basically, they yawned. No one was impressed. No one was very much moved. No one was very impressed. He did it time after time after time, and it basically was a flop. Now, would you like to know why it was a flop? I mean, it sounds pretty impressive. Making an elephant disappear, that's pretty good. You know, not pulling a rabbit out of your, not making your cufflinks, mean making an elephant disappear. The reason why it was a flop was because Harry Houdini was a horrible showman. He was a very good escape artist, and very good at holding his breath underwater in the frigid cold for seemingly unlimited amount of time. But as a showman, he was lousy. And the buildup was terrible, the presentation was lousy, and he did a bad job at marking it. Hence, the audience was bored because it just didn't kick, just didn't make it, just didn't move anything. And despite the fact that for decades after, the magicians were asking how did they do it and debating it, it became a flop in terms of magic. Why do I share that with you? Because you'll excuse me for saying it in this way, but our creator, if it could be, is also, excuse my saying it, is a lousy showman. When Hashem runs this world, it's a magnificent performance. It's astounding. It's absolutely stupendous. Yet if it could be, Hashem is a very poor showman, not by accident, but by design. You could look at the wonders of this world, the wonders of creation, the most astounding thing, far greater than hiding an elephant. And you could actually say, clever, cute, I caught it. Another sleight of hand, another trick, a little photosynthesis, a little cellular division, a little DNA, not a big deal. The fact that there's more computer programming in a microscopic little thing that man can't even see with an electron microscope than they've ever put into any computer. You know, whatever, don't get bent out of shape, it's two spirals, one goes around the other. It's a little illusion. Don't really get religious on me. And if it could be, Hashem created this most magnificent thing called physicality, creation, nature, and people could look at it and say, what's next? And not be moved. And Rabosai, I think there's a huge chiddush here. Nature, the world we live in, is the most astounding revelation of Hashem. But you have to train yourself to see it. You have to study it. You have to look for the trick. But when you see the trick, you have to say it's not a mechanism, that's Hashem. It's not by accident, that's Hashem's design. And when you get to the ultimate level, you see it's not just Hashem's design and His mechanism. That's Hashem involved in every part of the world. And when you do that, you grow in understanding. You grow in emunah. Ultimately, you see Hashem involved in every part of this world. And Hashem grant us understanding, ability to put into plan. Please join us after Marav for Hatha Shmuz. And thank you.